Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the World Affairs Council of Maine in Portland for a talk called Trump, Bolton, and the Iran Deal, an evening with Trita Parsi. Trita Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He'll talk about the secret meetings that led to the deal and what will happen if it's abandoned. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and the program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. You'll also be able to find it as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Kate McCarthy, Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Maine.
I'm Kate. I'm the new ED of the World Affairs Council of Maine. I'm about 3 months in, and I can say that I am still pinching myself that I have the opportunity to be working toward promoting global citizenship in Maine. Thank you to our sponsors. This is the fourth program that Veril Dana has hosted for us. Thank you to Chris, our board member, for helping to put this all together and our other programs. And thank you to Anne Blanchard. She has fielded approximately 1 million questions from me over the last 6 weeks, so thank you. Also want to thank ProAV Systems. They are sponsoring the professional recording of tonight's event. They are New England's leading audio-visual integrator. They are APEX certified and focus on corporate office spaces like this one, K-20 classrooms, government environments, and healthcare facilities. Now on to Dr. Parsi's bio. He is an award-winning author with a focus on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. His first book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S., won the 2010 Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order and the Council of Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Award in 2008. His second book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, was selected as the best book on the Middle East in 2012 by Foreign Affairs. And his latest book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, reveals the behind-the-scenes story to the historic nuclear deal with Iran. Dr. Parsi was born in Iran, but moved with his family at the age of 4 to Sweden in order to escape political repression in Iran. His father was an outspoken academic and non-Muslim who was jailed by the Shah and then by the Ayatollah. He moved to the U.S. as an adult and studied foreign policy at Johns Hopkins University for advanced international studies, where he received his PhD. He founded the National Iranian American Council to provide a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization through which Iranian Americans could participate in American civic life. NIAC is a vocal proponent of dialogue and engagement between the U.S. and Iran, which Parsi consistently has argued would enhance our national security by helping to stabilize the Middle East and bolster the moderates in Iran. He has taught at Johns Hopkins University and George Washington University. He currently teaches at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And today, he has traveled up to Portland, Maine to join us. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kate. Thank you to Chris and to Veril Dana and the World Affairs Council for having me here today. Thank you all for coming. Now, when it comes to the diplomacy between the United States and Iran, and particularly when it comes to this nuclear deal, I think it's important to recognize that this was never just about the nuclear deal. The consequences of this went well beyond the nuclear issue itself. It really ranges from war to peace. And that's where I would like to begin here today. I want to take you back to April 2012, at a time when the United States is imposing crippling, truly, truly painful sanctions on Iran. The Iranians are aggressively going forward with their nuclear program. The Israelis are making regular threats of taking military action, which would have disrupted the entire situation. At this moment, a most unusual group of people gather in a very, very small country in Europe, far away from the eyes of the media. There were several Iranian officials in this gathering, including two members of the Iranian nuclear negotiation team. There were several high-ranking American officials, including one very, very senior American general. But perhaps most surprisingly, there were five senior Israelis at this meeting. At a time when the Iranians and the Israelis hardly talk to each other, the Iranians don't even recognize Israel's right to exist, to find them in the same room, to find them actually communicating with each other, was quite unusual, to say the least. But what was even more unusual was what actually was said. I'm going to give you a quote. "This is not about enrichment. This was never about enrichment." The Israeli official looked straight across the room into the eyes of the Iranians when he uttered these words. Surprising many of us, because for two decades we had heard repeatedly that Iran's nuclear program, particularly its enrichment of uranium, constituted an existential threat to Israel. But now instead, the Israelis were telling it straight to the Iranians. It's actually not about enrichment. Instead, he continued, Israel would like to see a sweeping attitude change on behalf of Iran, pointing out that Israel could not accept that Iran continued to deny Israel's right to exist, and that it feared that if the United States and Iran struck a deal, regardless of the details of this deal, it would essentially mean that the United States would come to terms with Iran without Iran coming to terms with Israel, and that this was completely unacceptable to Israel. And he made it very clear that Israel would do everything in its power to prevent any such nuclear deal being struck, precisely because of this fear of abandonment. The fear that if the United States struck a deal with Iran without a major change on Iran's policies vis-a-vis Israel, the United States would then move on to other global crises. It would have reduced its tensions with Iran, not fully resolved them, but reduced them. But it would move on to other issues. But Israel would continue to be stuck in the region, facing a hostile Iran, but now without the full backing of the United States. And the Israelis made it very clear that this was completely unacceptable to them. This was not just a moment of clarity, it was a moment of utmost honesty about what the actual driving forces of this conflict was about. That it wasn't so much the nuclear issue itself, but what it could symbolize if it led to a scenario in which the U.S. and Iran actually did improve their relations without any change in the relationship between Israel and Iran at the same time. To better understand the logic and why the Israelis felt this way, we need to go back another two decades, 1991 to 1992. It's a moment in which you have two major geopolitical shocks to the world. On the one hand, the Soviet Union collapses, and on the other hand, Saddam Hussein is defeated in the Middle East through a UN coalition led by the United States. So you have, on the one hand, the global order changing in the sense that the U.S. is now the sole superpower. And on the regional scale, the balance of power, the order is completely disrupted, but it's not clear what type of order would come and replace it. This created a major challenge and an opportunity both for the Israelis and the Iranians. In the 1970s and 80s, the Iranians and the Israelis actually had dealt with each other extensively behind the scenes. Despite the very venomous anti-Israeli rhetoric of the Iranian government after the revolution, the bottom line was that the Iranians and the Israelis still felt that there was a common security imperative that pushed the two countries closer together. That was the threat from the Soviet Union, that was strong Arab nationalist powers such as Egypt under Nasser or Iraq under Saddam Hussein. These two factors drove the two countries together despite of the Islamic Revolution. But now, by 1991, 1992, these two factors had evaporated. There was no longer a Soviet Union, and there was no longer a military power in the Arab world that could pose that type of a common threat to both Iran and Israel. So you had now a new geopolitical constellation, one in which Iran and Israel increasingly stood out as two of the more powerful states in the region. And in a region that essentially is looking for an equilibrium, for a balance, powerful states will almost automatically be embroiled in a rivalry. And that's exactly what happened in the early 1990s. The Israelis were the ones who moved first, very cleverly, understanding this new situation. And they pushed the United States that if the U.S. wanted Israel to make peace with the Palestinians, then the United States needed to sanction and contain Iran and started depicting Iran as the new threat to the region. This is quite a shift from the Israeli side, I have to say, because only 5 years earlier, the Israelis were the one who were lobbying Washington to talk to Iran, to sell arms to Iran, and not to pay attention to Iranian rhetoric because it wasn't reflective of their actual policy. As I'm sure you all remember the Iran-Contra scandal. 5, 6 years later, the Israeli position shifts 180 degrees. For the Iranians, they thought that the end of the Cold War, they thought that the defeat of Saddam Hussein would give them an opportunity to be able to come out of the cold, to be able to regain their position in the region, come out of their isolation, an isolation that they, to a very large extent, had caused for themselves because of their radicalism. But instead, the United States decides to go with the recommendation of the Israelis and adopts a policy, a doctrine called dual containment. The new order in the region, the new balance in the region, would be based on Iraq and Iran's joint isolation and containment, and it would be centered on Israeli, Saudi, and Egyptian security. For the Israelis, this was a major victory. For the Iranians, this was a disaster. They thought they're going to come out of their isolation. Instead, the United States doubled down on their isolation. And that's when the Iranians moved towards trying to do everything they could to sabotage dual containment and bring it down. And their calculation was that the weakest link in the American strategy was the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, which was intimately linked to dual containment. Martin Indyk was the brainchild behind dual containment, and he said in an interview to me that these two things were symbiotic. The more Iran was isolated, the more we could get peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The more we had peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the more isolated Iran would become. The problem with that linkage is that it also works in the reverse. The more you undermine the Israeli peace process, the more you can break out of your isolation if you are Iran. And that's exactly what the Iranians did. They started targeting the peace process by supporting groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, etc., in the hope that by destroying the peace process, they would also put an end to the American order called dual containment and their own isolation. But despite everything the Iranians did to bring down dual containment, it was actually not Iran that succeeded in killing that policy. It was actually done by the United States itself, and more precisely by George W. Bush. By deciding to go in and do regime change in Iraq, by definition, we abandoned the policy of containing Iraq. Instead, now we're going to have regime change there, put in place a government that would be more sympathetic to the United States, and have an order in which we would use Iraq in order to balance and to contain Iran. But despite the goals of the Bush administration and the idea of creating a new order, what the Iraq war managed to do was not to create a new order, but only destroy the previous order. And since 2003, and particularly since 2005, the region has essentially been orderless. There is no balance of power in the Middle East right now. There is no equilibrium. There is no hegemon or any combination of powers that could take on the role of a hegemon to be able to establish a new order in the region. And this is precisely part of the reason why the region is so unstable right now. Because we are essentially in the middle of a transition from one equilibrium to the next. And that is exactly the moment in which the instability of the region is at its maximum, because we don't have any balance of power. Now, with the United States going into Iraq and destroying dual containment, the Iranians were actually quite happy about this, because this meant that the United States had taken out the Taliban to the east, they had taken out Saddam Hussein to the west, unleashing Iran and enabling Iran to spread its influence. For the Israelis and the Saudis, this was an absolute disaster. They had enjoyed maximum maneuverability under dual containment, but now instead, by changing the power and failing to create a new order, and the Iraq war was such a costly endeavor that it essentially put the United States in a position in which it no longer had the capacity on enforcing on the region a new equilibrium. It now meant that the Israelis and the Saudis had to deal with Iran in a way that did not happen prior to 2003 because the way that they were balanced by the United States and its power. So for the Iranians, this gave them an opportunity to be able to expand their influence in the region, but they still suffered from one major flaw, one major drawback. This new geopolitical constellation was favorable to them, but they couldn't lock it in because without any diplomacy with the United States, without the United States recognizing Iran as a regional power, the Iranians could not essentially cement the gains that they had made in the region. In order to be able to do so, they needed to have the U.S. come to the negotiating table and recognize that Iran was a major power in the region. And this is precisely why the Israelis did not want to see any U.S.-Iran diplomacy because of a fear that it would bring Iran this recognition. But ironically, the Israelis and the Iranians used the exact same instrument to achieve their opposite objectives, and that was the nuclear issue. For the Israelis, this was defined as an existential threat. And if you take an existential threat and you combine it with completely unrealistic objectives, and in this case was the objective of essentially you have to eliminate the entire Iranian nuclear program. Nothing less is acceptable. Zero enrichment. An existential threat combined with an unachievable objective would eventually lead to a scenario in which the U.S. would be forced to take military action because it eliminated any chance of a compromise. And the balance of power that would emerge in the Middle East after the U.S. took on Iran militarily, the Israelis calculated, would obviously be beneficial to Israel since the U.S. would win that war. The Iranians had a completely different calculation. Yes, going forward with the nuclear program definitely risked a military confrontation with the United States. But precisely because the war fatigue in the U.S., because of the way that the American public had turned against additional war in the region and because of the failure of Iraq, the calculation was that by raising the stakes, instead of ending up in war, the United States may end up being forced to change its objectives and adopt a much more flexible position on the nuclear issue and come to the table and recognize that Iran is a power in the region. And this was the crux of the dilemma for the United States. How do you prevent the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon without going to war, without allowing the Israelis to start a war, and without allowing the Iranians to end up in a situation in which they would be able to define the new balance in the region if you went to the negotiating table? That was the dilemma for the United States.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Trita Parsi is the president of the National Iranian American Council, discussing the circumstances that led to the Iran nuclear deal.
The track record of the Bush administration, I think, is quite clear. The Bush administration's strategy was, we don't talk to the Iranians. We don't engage in any diplomacy. We only pursue sanctions until we cripple their economy and force them to completely give up their nuclear program. Well, in 2003, the Iranians had roughly 150 centrifuges. Those are the machines you spin to enrich uranium to higher levels. You enrich it to 3.75% and you can use it for fuel. You go above 90%, you can use it for nuclear weapons. 150 in 2003. By the time Bush left office, the Iranians had 8,000 centrifuges. They had zero stockpile of low enriched uranium. That's the uranium at 3.75%. They had 1,500 kilos by the time Bush left office, enough to be able to build a bomb. Clearly, a different strategy was needed. And when Senator Barack Obama started to put together his plans for a presidential run, He made the idea of reconstituting diplomacy at the center of American statecraft a critical component of his election platform. And he talked about talking to countries we disagree with, whether it's Iran, Venezuela, or Cuba. But Iran became the poster child of this policy. But talking about diplomacy with Iran as a senator or a state senator from Illinois is very different from actually engaging in diplomacy with Iran. And within a year of coming into office and having made one attempt at diplomacy, which had failed, Obama quickly found himself pretty much where Bush had left off, with the same instrument at his disposal. Sanctions, pressure, economic coercion, sabotage, cyber warfare, all different types of pressure methods to be able to contain and push back the Iranian program, with one very significant difference. Precisely because Obama had tried diplomacy with Iran, which Bush had not, and precisely because he enjoyed a completely different level of international legitimacy compared to Bush, Obama could do what Bush couldn't, and that was to assemble the toughest and strongest sanctions coalition that Iran, or frankly, probably any country, had faced. The United States managed to convince the Chinese to cut down a significant amount of their oil trade with Iran, to get the South Koreans to impose sanctions on Iran. The Europeans completely eliminated all of their oil purchases from Iran, which constituted 40% of Iran's exports. The United States even imposed sanctions on Iran's central bank, effectively cutting Iran off of the international financial system. The week that was done, the Iranian currency dropped 30%. Over the course of 3 years, the Iranian GDP shrunk roughly 25%. Clearly, the Iranians had underestimated Obama. They did not think that he would ever be able to get that degree of buy-in for a sanctions policy. But Obama had also underestimated the Iranians. They were clearly hurting, but they were not breaking. Nor were they without a response. If the American strategy was that we're going to change Iran's cost-benefit analysis, we're going to make it so costly for them to go forward with their nuclear program so that they're going to make a cost-benefit calculation and conclude it's simply not worth continuing with this. Push them to a point in which they have to choose between having a nuclear program and having an economy. If that was the American strategy, the Iranian strategy was a complete mirror image of that strategy. They're going to double down on their nuclear program, expand their number of centrifuges, expand the low enrichment stockpile in order to convince the United States that that's what you get for more sanctions. That's the result of sanctions. The more sanctions you impose, the bigger the nuclear program you beget. And this created a race, a chicken race, but a three-way chicken race, with three different clocks ticking. On the one hand, you had the Iranian nuclear clock, in which the Iranians were trying to rush forward as quickly as possible and present the United States with a nuclear fait accompli. You had the American sanctions clock, in which we were trying to cripple their economy. And you had the Israeli wild card, in which if they had taken military action, the entire situation would have been disrupted. As these clocks are ticking, and no one has an idea what type of an exit we would be able to find out of this, there's this official negotiations taking place at the P5+1level, which really wasn't going anywhere. And a senator, not too far away from here, goes to the president and he convinces him, you're not going to get the Iranians to capitulate their nuclear program in the P5+1 talks. If they're going to back down, it's going to happen in very, very secret talks in which you have a direct link to the Iranian supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. That senator was John Kerry, who was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He had played a critical role in winning the release of three Americans who had wrongfully been jailed in Iran. I'm sure you all heard about the three American hikers. It's kind of sad because they hiked once, and now they're forever known to be hikers. They're actually quite well-established journalists, teachers of English that were stationed in the region. They had decided to get together one weekend in Iraqi Kurdistan to go hiking. And reality is they actually never entered Iran. They were walking on the Iraqi side of the border. The border is unmarked. They see a couple of soldiers who waves them over. They comply, and as they walk over to these soldiers, not knowing that they're Iranian soldiers, unbeknownst to them, they walk into Iranian territory. They're arrested and accused of spying. And John Kerry, together with the country of Oman, managed to win their release through secret negotiations. And the Omanis did this because they wanted to show the United States that they have the capacity to maneuver the very complex Iranian political system. And they wanted to prove that to the U.S., to convince the U.S., use Oman's help to resolve the nuclear issue, because they were terrified that this chicken race would actually lead to a war rather than to a settlement of the issue. The president was convinced, and in July 2012, a first meeting is set up outside of Muscat in Oman on the Arabian Peninsula. Two mid-level American officials go there, an equal amount from the Iranian side. And from the American perspective, the objective with this meeting was twofold. One, to confirm and establish that this is an authoritative channel, that this has the green light of the supreme leader, and that they're negotiating on his behalf. Because there was no value in wasting time talking to people who actually didn't have a mandate to negotiate. And the second reason was to go and see how close are the Iranians to capitulating because of all of this pressure. The Iranians came for a completely different reason. They came to see how close is the U.S. to capitulating because of all of the pressure they thought they had put on the U.S. because of the expansion of the nuclear program. So as you can imagine, the meeting was a complete disaster, a total failure, and both sides walked away quite disappointed, and the channel almost collapsed. Then you had the elections in the U.S. in November. These kind of things are then put on hold. But by January 2013, a completely different sense of urgency dawns on the White House. Exactly a year earlier, then Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta had stated publicly that Iran's breakout capability is 12 months. Breakout capability is the measurement in which you see the time it takes for the Iranians from making a decision to build a bomb to having the ready material for a bomb. Not having the weapons ready, not having the delivery system, but having the ready material. It would take the Iranians 12 months based on the size of their program and their stockpile. By January 2013, Iran's breakout capability had shrunk to 8 to 12 weeks. And if it shrunk even further, even taking military action would no longer be possible. Clearly, the Iranian nuclear clock was actually ticking faster than the sanctions clock. And the president realized that unless something changed, the United States would soon only be faced with two options. It either had to accept Iran as a de facto nuclear power, or it would have to go to war. Unless something changed. And that's why in March of 2013, they went back to Oman. But this time around, it wasn't two mid-level American officials. Instead, it was a full delegation with some of the top non-proliferation experts in the U.S. government, led by the number two at the State Department, then Ambassador Bill Burns. But perhaps more importantly, for the very, very first time, the American diplomats were armed with an instrument that they had never been allowed to touch before. And that was a very carefully crafted statement declaring when and under what circumstances and what limitations the United States would be willing to accept enrichment on Iranian soil, meaning an abandonment of the long-standing American position that there could be no enrichment in Iran at all. This was Iran's bottom line, their absolute red line that they were not willing to compromise, regardless of how much pressure was put on them. And the president had concluded that this card that was planned to be played at some point, but most likely at the end of the negotiation, had to be played at the very beginning of the negotiations to even get the talks to reach a serious level. And this is exactly what the Iranians had been looking for. But despite the fact that they were now moving so much closer, not only on substance, but on the most important core issue that separated two countries, it still was not enough. Because at the end of the day, after 40 years of mutual demonization, the Iranians didn't trust the U.S., the Americans didn't trust Iran. And the Iranians could not go back to Tehran and say, well, the Americans promised that they would accept it. They needed it in writing. And the U.S. had very strict instructions. They can absolutely not put anything in writing, because if it leaked, it could cause the collapse of the P5+1 talks. It would create massive tensions with America's allies. And it could also lead to the Iranians pocketing the concession without giving anything in return. So here you have them. They had actually managed to essentially resolve a core issue, but because of their distrust, they still could not capitalize on it. And the question was, who is out there that has that relationship, both with the President of the United States and with Iran's supreme leader, and as a result can bridge the trust gap between the two? Who's their common Facebook friend that could step in and resolve this issue? Well, the only person that came to mind was the Sultan of Oman, who enjoys very strong relations with the U.S., a long-standing American ally, and for historic reasons has very good relations with the Iranians as well. And the idea emerged that if the U.S. cannot put this in writing, well, perhaps, and send it to the Iranians, perhaps it can send a letter to the Omanis instead, spelling out the American position. The Omanis would then, the Sultan would, in between his chemotherapy, travel to Tehran, meet face-to-face with the supreme leader of Iran, not show him the letter, but convey to him its contents. And the calculation being was that if the Iranians still said no, it would not be because they were now expressing mistrust of the United States. They would be expressing mistrust of the Sultan. And since the relationship with him was so strong, the calculation was the Iranians are not going to end up doing that. If the Sultan goes and does this, they're going to be forced to say yes, essentially. And that's exactly how this got resolved. Secretly, behind the scenes, this is actually during Ahmadinejad being president. This is even before Rouhani comes in. And I wanted to mention this part of the story, partly because it's unknown, but also to make a couple of points. First of all, to show the creativity and the patience that is needed in order to be able to reach international agreements, particularly with countries that the United States has had bad relations with for such a long period of time. Secondly, to show that despite the U.S. being the most powerful country in the world, it does not matter how powerful the U.S. is. Even a country as powerful as the United States still needs friends to make deals of this kind, to be able to reach agreements. And we need to keep this in mind, particularly right now, when we're dealing not only with Iran again, but perhaps even more dangerously with North Korea, that in the absence of friends and in the absence of respecting our friends, we're not going to have the capacity to be able to utilize diplomacy as effectively as we need to. And the third point is that in this era where we hear so much about Sunni-Shia tensions and Arab-Persian tensions, all true, perhaps a bit exaggerated nevertheless, we should still remember that it actually was an Arab country that brought the United States and Iran closer together. Now, before I stop, I'm going to leave you with two additional points, and I'm sure we're going to have plenty of questions about what's going to happen now. But let me say two other things. First is, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu positioned himself as the foremost opponent of the deal during these negotiations, and he truly did everything he could to kill the deal. He went as far as going to Congress at the invitation of one party to give a speech in Congress against the sitting president of the United States, an unprecedented move. But of all of the things that he did, and he called this the worst deal ever, the best triumph for the Iranians, of all the things he did, there was actually one thing he could have done, a much, much simpler thing he could have done, that would have actually caused the deal to cause the diplomacy to collapse. And that is, instead of going to the cameras and saying that this is the worst deal of the century, this is the capitulation of the West, he should have gone to the cameras and said, we in Israel love this deal. This is an amazing deal. This is our victory and this is Iran's defeat. In one of my interviews with the Iranian foreign minister in the midst of these talks, I asked him, what would you have done if Benjamin Netanyahu hugged the deal? And he came out and said that this is a great thing. And he told me, and I have it quoted in the book, he said, look, we would have most likely had to walk out of the negotiations if the Israelis started endorsing the talks and endorsing the deal. Because it was very easy for him to deal with Netanyahu's criticism. His criticism was saying that the Iranians are master negotiators and they're striking the best deal ever. That actually helped shut up the hardliners in Washington that were in Tehran that were criticizing. But if Netanyahu had come out and endorsed the deal, it would have created such a domestic political dilemma for the negotiators that they, according to him, would most likely have to walk out of the deal. Second point, we hear a lot that there were much better deals that we could have struck. That if we had just kept on with the pressure a little bit longer, we could have gotten a better deal. And this is part of the motivation as to what is happening right now. We got to scrap this and go back to the negotiating table and get a better deal. And the Obama administration's response is that, no, this was the best deal that we could have gotten. I actually think there were better deals, much better deals from the U.S. perspective that could have been struck. They did not exist in 2015, however. They existed much earlier. In 2003, when the Iranians only had 150 centrifuges, they sent a proposal to the Bush administration through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who had been tasked by the U.S. government to be the official go-between, the official channel of communications between the U.S. and Iran. This proposal came in about 2 or 3 weeks after the United States had taken Baghdad. And the Iranians essentially put everything on the table. It was a comprehensive proposal, a grand bargain. And as part of this, they offered to discuss American objectives, such as opening up the nuclear program for full transparency, to collaborate against all terrorist organizations, above all Al-Qaeda, to support the stabilization of Iraq and make sure that the government there would end up being a non-sectarian one, the same thing the Iranians actually had done in Afghanistan only 18 months earlier. Perhaps most surprisingly, sign on to the Beirut Declaration, the Saudi peace plan from 2002, in which the Saudis called on all Arab countries to recognize Israel in return for an Israeli recognition of a Palestinian state, which would have been the closest the Iranians ever would have gotten to de jure recognizing an Israeli state. I was working in Congress at the time, and my boss had lived in Iran before the revolution, was the only Farsi-speaking member of Congress, and recognized as the most knowledgeable person in Congress about Iran. So whenever the Swiss ambassador came to Washington, which was usually every 5 to 6 months, he would stop by our office to give us a briefing on what the situation was on the ground. And he did so this time as well, and he actually gave us a copy of the proposal. You have it in the appendix of the book. And he did so because he wanted to make sure that the proposal would get to the president. There was a fear that if it only went to the State Department, it would not end up reaching Bush himself. So my boss sent it over to the White House through a page, and within 2 hours, Karl Rove called. He said that he found it intriguing. He wanted to know if it was authentic. We said, to the best of our knowledge, it is. It's coming from the Swiss. And that's the last we heard of it, until about 4 months later, there's an article in the Financial Times that says that the Iranians had sent some form of a comprehensive negotiation proposal to the U.S., and the Bush administration had decided not to give any response to Iran and instead reprimand the Swiss ambassador for having delivered it in the first place. 2005, the Iranians sent another proposal. This time, the last proposal before Ahmadinejad gets elected and they really start ramping up the nuclear program. The proposal was given to the Europeans who were handling the negotiations at the time, and they decided not to even send it to Washington because the Iranians offered to cap their program at 3,000 centrifuges. And since the Europeans knew Bush would not accept anything above zero, they didn't even bother sending it. At one of the meetings we had at the White House, I was advising the Obama administration during the talks. One of my colleagues asked, we're trying to figure out, where do you think you're going to end up on the enrichment issue and the centrifuge numbers? And we asked, do you think it's possible to get back to the proposal the Iranians put on the table in 2005? And the American negotiators started laughing and said, you know, we would jump on that opportunity if it existed today. But we're constantly chasing the deals we could have gotten 2 years ago. That ship has sailed. couple of weeks later, I'm in Lausanne, where some of the talks are taking place, and I'm having an interview with Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, and I ask him the same thing. I ask him, where do you think you're going to end up on the centrifuge? Do you think you're going to keep more than what you were offering to cap it at in 2005? He actually wrote that proposal. And he started laughing and said, 3,000? Oh, that was just an opening bid. We were going to settle for 1,000 centrifuges. Well, by the time the interim deal was struck in 2013, the Iranians had 22,000 centrifuges. As a result of the deal, after a decade of sanctions, the Iranians went back to 5,000 centrifuges, still 2,000 more than their opening bid in 2005. I'm saying this because I think we have kind of fooled ourselves to think that because of our sanctions, we were essentially negotiating Iran's capitulation. That was not the case. On the contrary, the combination of only focusing on pressure and combining it with completely unrealistic objectives actually gave the Iranians an opportunity to significantly enhance their negotiating position. And this is something we absolutely need to keep in mind, particularly now when we are apparently going to have some sort of a meeting with the North Koreans. That if we combine only pressure tactics with no diplomacy and no incentives with unrealistic objectives, most likely we're actually doing the other side a favor. It may make us look tough. It may make us look really strong, but in reality, if you scratch the surface and look at it objectively, we see we're actually giving the other side time, and that's exactly what happened in the Iran case. I'll stop there. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Trita Parsi is talking about the Iran deal and will now answer questions from the audience, which we'll repeat for clarity.
So the question is, what do I think the Iranians will do if Trump goes forward with what seems to be an almost foregone conclusion that by May 12th, which is a deadline for the U.S. to renew sanctions waivers, if he fails to do so, then the U.S. is effectively outside of the deal? I think it's very naive to expect that the Iranians will continue to comply with an agreement if they're not going to be getting the benefits of that agreement. If the U.S. walks out and reimposes the sanctions, then the Iranians are not getting the economic benefit of having restricted their program. The idea that they would still stick to that is very unlikely. The only scenario in which this could happen is if the Europeans decide that they're going to step up and they're going to replace the U.S. and essentially triple their economic engagement with the Iranians. I find that very unlikely. Because even under these circumstances, the European companies have not been going to Iran to the extent that people expected, which was largely because they were afraid that the U.S. would pull out of the deal and they didn't want to end up getting sanctioned. This has actually created an interesting dilemma for the Iranians. The Iranian strategy during the negotiations was quite fascinating to observe this. In any of these negotiations, there is a tension between two objectives that your plan A and your plan B. Your plan A, obviously, should be to get the deal. To get the deal, you have to make sure that you do not do too much public posturing and you do not leak information too much, because the more you leak, the more you're likely to undermine the chances of achieving your plan A. But if you're at the same time afraid that you're not going to get your plan A, you need to have a plan B, and that plan B usually has to be to make sure that the other side is blamed for the failure. And to ensure that the other side is blamed, you actually have to do some leaking in order to be able to position yourself well so you don't get blamed for it. Well, the Iranian strategy of trying to minimize the tensions between the plan A and the plan B was a rather interesting one. They adopted an almost ridiculous, optimistic public posture about the likelihood of getting a deal, essentially trying to come across as uber reasonable and being very, very optimistic, because on the one hand, they actually enhanced the chances of getting your plan A, and if it failed, it would look as if the much more cautious and skeptical American side was to blame. But the Iranians miscalculated on one critical point. What is the outcome of this? Particularly once they got the deal, they continued with this, and part of their strategy was to make sure that they really lived up to the deal, did not give anyone any excuses to say that they were not living up to the deal, so we have 10 IAEA reports, consecutive reports, saying they're complete compliance. Well, and side effect that they had not anticipated, is that it actually made it look as if Iran was desperate to keep the deal, that they were going so far to keep this deal and complying, et cetera, that they were actually desperate to make sure that they kept these economic benefits, which then led to a narrative that said, you know what, the U.S. actually can walk out of the deal. The U.S. actually can mess with it. The Iranians have no choice. They're going to be forced to stick with it because they're in such a desperate economic situation. Right now, I think they're under pressure to do something drastic in order to dispel this narrative, to prove it wrong. And I'm afraid that if the United States walks out of the deal, instead of the Iranians reacting proportionately, they may actually do something even more aggressive just to be able to change that narrative and make sure that it doesn't lead to additional pressures on them. So I'm extremely worried that if the president walks out, he is going to trigger a series of events in which neither side will have escalation control. And both sides will be under a tremendous amount of domestic pressures to be able to escalate further. And we will then very quickly, likely, end up in a scenario worse than what it was in 2012, 2013. Because at least in January 2013, when the president recognized that the sanctions clock was not ticking as fast as the nuclear clock, at least he had the option of saying, okay, let's go back to Oman. Let's go back to the negotiating table and see if we can change some of the parameters here. Once we walk out of this deal, I find it extremely unlikely that we're going to be able to get back to the negotiating table. Because every other country that is party to this deal believes it is working perfectly and that it should be kept. It is embodied in a UN Security Council resolution. The United States really lacks the credibility to be able to tell these parties, we have to go back and renegotiate this deal. So without that diplomatic exit, if you're in this situation with no escalation control and no exit ramps, that is a pretty grim situation to be in.
How does Iran's missile development play into the nuclear deal?
Those missiles, the Iranian missile program, long precedes the agreement, though. The Iranians they started having missiles already back in the 1970s. The Israelis were the ones who were selling them, some of the original missiles that they've been using. But in comparison to other states in the region, in the 1980s, they had very, very little missile capability. And when Saddam Hussein started sending missiles into Iran during the Iraq-Iran war, he could hit Tehran from the most western point of Iraq. The Iranians had such bad missile technology, they had to be inside of Iraqi territory in order to be able to retaliate against Baghdad. So after the war, they started to immensely invest in their missile technology. They could not rebuild an air force worthy of the name because neither the Russians, the U.S., or any Western power was willing to sell anything to them. And I think, just to give you some context, we hear a lot about their missiles, etc., and they probably have the largest stockpile of missiles right now, but Iran's military budget is one-fifth of that of Saudi Arabia. Iran's military budget is almost half of what UAE has, and UAE has a population that is not even a 50th of that of Iran. So comparatively in the region, the Iranians are spending far, far less on military than almost any other power, even measured in absolute terms as well as in per capita terms. Now, the missiles ended up being in the UN Security Council because of the fear that the Iranians were developing nuclear weapons. And the Iranians are members of the NPT, so they would be violating the NPT if they started building nuclear weapons. So that brought them into the Security Council. There's no agreement that the Iranians have signed that would give the international community the authority to regulate its missiles. So it couldn't go into the Security Council just for the missiles itself. But because of the combination, it went into the Security Council. Once the deal was struck, and essentially the deal prevented the Iranians from having any pathway to a nuclear weapon, technically the missile issue should actually have become a non-issue because it was only a concern in the combination with Iran having weapons capability, nuclear weapons capability. But the U.S. still managed to make sure that there was a mention of the missiles in the Security Council that embodied this deal. But the language was so weakened that it was essentially only calling on Iran not to test missiles that are designed and capable of carrying nuclear weapons. And that's part of the reason why, despite their missile test, there has not been any rebuke from the Security Council, because it doesn't fit the criteria. They would have to test missiles that are designed and capable of carrying nuclear weapons, and they don't qualify for that. But does that mean that Iran's nuclear program is not a concern? I absolutely think it is a concern, and it's something that should be addressed. The problem, though, is that the approach of the Trump administration now is that they want to kill the nuclear deal in order to address the missiles issue. The way to do it is to first recognize that the only time in the last 40 years that we've been able to change a core Iranian policy, security policy, has been through these negotiations. Everything else we've tried has either failed or made the situation worse. So if we have genuine concerns about missiles, about Iran's role in Syria, about Iran's role in Yemen, then there is a path with a proven track record of success, and that's the multilateral diplomatic route. And then there's plenty of paths with no track record of success. So if we want to address it, we should use the path that has a success. We should first respect the nuclear deal, abide by it, make sure that it continues to live, and then build upon it and add new negotiations that addresses these other issues. Instead of thinking that we can go to the negotiating table, not honoring the deal that we already have signed and expect the Iranians to sign an additional deal with us. That's part of the reason why the Europeans are not taking the U.S. seriously right now, because it's very difficult to be convinced that Trump is doing this because he actually believes he's going to be able to achieve anything.
Why should the U.S. trust Iran with the financial parameters of the deal?
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that issue. Because there's been a lot of talk about that, $100 billion, et cetera. Let me give you a little bit of a background and also tell you what the U.S. intelligence is saying about this issue. Candidate Trump made a big issue saying we gave the Iranians, he used to say $150 billion, that we gave $150 billion of our money to them. That is absolutely incorrect. There is no basis whatsoever for that. What happened was that during the sanctions years, the United States pressured these foreign banks, primarily Japanese and Swiss banks, to freeze all the money the Iranians had in their accounts. And as part of the deal, their money was unfrozen, meaning it wasn't American money that went to them. It was their money that was in these banks that was used to be able to finance the imports that they had from those countries that they were given access back to. So it's not $100 billion of American money that went there. Secondly, I don't know what they've used them for. I do know what the U.S. intelligence says, and they're not indicating what you're saying. What the U.S. intelligence is saying is the Iranians actually have had great difficulty being able to get the money back to their own banks. So the money is still sitting in a bunch of foreign banks and has continued to be able to be used for imports, primarily food stuff. I've not heard about, you know, the fighter jets or anything like that. When it comes to the missile defense agreement that the Iranians had with the Russians was signed several years ago. It was financed and paid for prior to this deal. It only was delivered after the Iranians signed the deal. So they had already paid for it before the deal. So that for sure had nothing to do with $100 billion. But I'm still happy you bring this up, because it again gives the impression that we can get a deal and we can get the Iranians to go down from 22,000 centrifuges to 5,000, to have 10,000 kilos of low-enriched uranium and then ship 97% of that out, not being able to have more than 400 kilos of LU at any point during the deal, which means that there's no way they can build a nuclear weapon, and still expect that we can get all of that without giving anything in return. That's not the way international diplomacy works. Even a country as powerful as the United States cannot impose such criteria for any deal. The only way to actually get them to go back on an issue that many had defined to be an existential issue was to also offer something in return. And ensuring that they got access back to their money is a very, very small price to pay in the larger scheme of things, of making sure that they don't have any pathway to a nuclear weapon.
Is there any objective basis on which we can claim Iran is not complying with the deal? Are there factions of Iran that don't want to see the deal renewed?
Great question. So there's no one who have said with any factual basis that the Iranians are out of compliance. The body that is refereeing this is the International Atomic Energy Agency. They write a report every 3 months. Every report has said that they are in compliance. There's been one instance in which As I mentioned, they're only supposed to have 400 kilos of LEU. I think they had gone above with 2 or 3 kilos at one point. They had actually reported that to the IAEA themselves, and that's why it was in the IAEA report. Trump has argued that they are in violation of the spirit of the deal. And I wrote the book on it. I never came across the spirit. But what he's referring to, what came through in some of the conversations, is that in the preamble of the deal, it says that the full implementation of the deal will contribute to stability in the region. And then Tillerson, in the private meeting at the Security Council at the UN last September, said Iran is in violation of this because the region is more unstable now than it was 3 years ago. But no point of causality. And more importantly, the language says the full implementation of the deal. The deal had not been fully implemented. In fact, so much of it has not been implemented yet. Would contribute, not stabilize, would contribute to stability. We're 2 years into it, and essentially was saying that based on this, a preamble, the Iranians were in violation of the spirit of the deal. No other country in the P5 plus one or the Security Council agree with this point. And I think Trump has actually not even tried to use this argument for the last 6 months or so. So that's on your first question. The second question is, are there factions? Yes, they have their own hardliners. And for them, this has been a vindication of their narrative. They were opposed to some of these this diplomacy, and they're saying that, look, this is going to end up badly because the U.S. will end up betraying this deal. You cannot trust the U.S. And then you had the moderates who were saying, no, there's a reason why relations between the United States and Iran has not worked out. There's been problems on both ends. If we both make a good faith effort and if we live up to our end of the bargain, the other side will reciprocate. The moderates seem to have won the argument in 2015. 2018, it seems like the hardline narrative is gaining more traction inside of Iran because at the end of the day, Trump is openly pulling out of the deal. Now, for them, it's not just about the deal. It's also about the domestic politics. If the deal collapses, it will be, they believe, the end of the Rouhani government. It will be the end of the political forces in Iran that wanted to move closer to the United States, wanted to, through diplomacy, find a way to coexist. And those who much more argue that this should be more either a confrontational style or Iran just shifting its focus towards Russia and China, they will be winning out. So it's not just about what's happening in the deal, it's the domestic political consequences that is driving them at this point. Thank you all so much for coming. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council. He recently spoke with the World Affairs Council of Maine about the Iran nuclear deal. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it online at mainepublic.org. Click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Grails. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.